Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Windcaller and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. On this here episode 221, we're going to have the first part of the Ask Ryan Quarantine Quad. Quad because I believe it's going to be four parts. This guy really delivered, and this guy is none other than Ryan Monkman from Fieldbird Cider, based in Ontario, Canada. Let's first get a little bit of news out and about in Ciderville to bring us up to date, and this is going to be a little dispatch coming in from the United Kingdom. I was invited to a spontaneous Google Hangout with my friends at Duck Chicken. That's both Colleen and James. Those folks are so good at like calling out and saying, hey, you online right now? You want to do that? And they caught me at a perfect time. And they also were talking about Perry and chatting with Albert Johnson of the Ross-on-Wye Cider and Perry Company based in Ross-on-Wye. Now, all these folks you've heard me mentioning quite a bit because there is an upcoming England Cider Tour. So I think this will give you a good idea of what we're doing there and what we are, you know, hoping and praying for. So let's cut to that mini chat right now coming in from the UK. What's happening out in Ross-on-Wye? How are you doing out there? Is it like, are all the streets quiet and, you know, the yew tree pub is...
Yeah, everything is pretty quiet around our place. So the yew tree, we shut it on March 20th. That's when all pubs in the country had to shut. We did 2 days of takeaway sales from the cider shop. And then I decided, no, we're just going to shut completely. That's what we should do. That's the right thing to do. So we did. And we're not open still. But we've got a few people who do online web shops. So we've been actually selling quite a lot through that. So we're actually doing totally fine right now. Who knows where things are going to go, and especially because, you know, the summer's where you do make your sales in the UK for cider. And we're not going to be able to match probably the heights of what was happening in the summer, but everything should be okay. All of our pub staff are on the government furlough scheme, and we're topping them up the 20%. So this is the nice thing about still being busy with the trade sales. Right now we can afford to do that, and because we've still got all of our bills. And actually, we're looking to invest in a neck freezer because we've got a load of Perry's coming out that we want to disgorge because they've got that really ropey sediment. Yeah. So we're hoping to get rid of that. But we've just been grafting. And then we're expecting and hoping that a really big export order to Russia is going to go ahead at the end of May.
Wow.
So we've been bottling and kegging for that.
Where would that go into Russia?
We have a contact who runs a pub in Belgorod in the south near the Black Sea. Mm-hmm. But he also has distributors that buy it off him and sell it around Moscow and St. Petersburg and the other population centers. So it's our biggest customer, actually.
So you've been regularly selling to Russia. I didn't know that.
The last 4 years, yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
Right on. Wow. I just had a Russian cider this weekend, and it.
Yeah, I saw the photo. Oh,
man, that was so good. Have you had any of his cider, Maxim?
No.
Because he came to the UK and he took the Peter Mitchell course. He's really connected to the UK, is what I want to say. So
yeah,
tip of the hat to that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it seems like cider in Russia is on its way up quite dramatically.
Totally.
And quite quickly.
I wanted to ask you, Albert, what are you thinking about for the Ross Cider Fest and stuff?
Well, so right now we're hoping that it's going to be able to go ahead. So I was saying to James Clean, what we've done right now is we've suspended ticket sales. So we've sold about somewhere around 100, maybe 120. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that we don't know if they'll be allowing gatherings of any quantity or any size in September. But if we keep it to this level right now, until we do know, this is our best chance of being able to go ahead, even with some form of distancing.
Right.
But I don't know. I mean, I really hope that we can do it. We're all hoping we can. And it's just, I mean, the UK's response feels a little bit lackluster at the moment. So who knows, basically.
Yeah, I'm still holding out for the UK Cider Tour, and
I talked
to the London group that I'm working with, you know, setting the arrangements, and they're like willing to go up to the last end. I might switch things up, you know, so it's going to be a play by, you know, play, and it really depends at this moment for me, and I'm sure you too, and everybody. It's just like the politics, the leadership, you know, what's going on there.
Exactly.
That's like the biggest thing. Like, stop being bozos.
Yeah,
you know.
Much.
Hello.
Weird, your lucky little friend misses you. She's come out to see. She's come out to say hi.
Oh, Piccadilly.
Yeah.
Oh.
And she comes back. We'll grab her.
Awesome. Thank you, Piccadilly the cat, for redirecting us off of politics. The little people and the animals always save the day that way. And also, again, thanks to James Mann and Colleen O'Sullivan of Duck Chicken. And that was a nice check-in with Albert Johnson of the Ross Cider and Perry Company, based in Ross-on-Wye. If you are interested in the England Cider Tour, it's heading out on the 1st through the 6th of this year. And I am extending the sign-up period through to June, which will be then checking in again. You can find out more at the Totally Cider page at ciderchat.com.
Walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
It's time now for part one of the Ask Ryan Quarantine Quad Series. Yeah, we're getting into it. This is going to be going over for the next couple of weeks. I've broken down this long recording I had with Ryan as he was answering questions from you, Ciderville. You really delivered. I asked a couple of weeks ago to send in your questions, and it was a great range of questions, and we're going to start first with a question coming in from Michael. He actually sent in three questions, and Ryan will be answering that. Then the following episode, 222, will be part two of that series, and I'll give you a little teaser on the end of what we're going to be talking about there. So there's a lot to be had. You could go to the show notes to see what the actual questions are and a little short transcript of the answers that Ryan is providing. Who is Ryan? Well, he's none other than Ryan Monkman. He is part of Fieldbird Cider that he and his wife, Nicole, have set up in Prince Edward County, which is on the north shore of Lake Ontario in Ontario, Canada. I met Ryan a couple years back, and our friendship just continues to grow. And, you know, you become friends when your friends start blaming you for different things. You'll hear on this episode, well, I don't know if it's this episode or what part of the series. I think it's actually at the end of this Quarantine Quad series where, you know, you'll hear what trouble I got him into. But it's always good trouble when it's with friends, isn't it? Anyways, I adore this guy, and I know that many listeners who have had the opportunity to both meet him and listen to some of his earlier episodes, this guy knows his stuff. And he's, as actually Albert Johnson, while I was on that recent recording with him from the UK, said he's like an encyclopedia of knowledge, and I absolutely agree. So without further ado, let's go to the first segment of Ask Ryan with Ryan Monkman of Fieldbird Cider. Well, let's get into the first question, Ryan, and this one is from Michael, and it's in regards to barrel char. Is there a general aging graph for size and barrel char to achieving standard levels of tannin and oak flavor?
There is not, unfortunately. The first thing is, when we talk about barrel flavor, we often talk about like toastiness flavor. That we can just generally subcategorize into French and American oak for this conversation. And that French oak tends to have less aromatics and more tannin. And American oak tends to have more aromatics, more flavor, but less tannin. You start at that point. And then how you toast a barrel or char a barrel will have an impact on those things. So the more you toast a barrel, the more you char it, the more you diminish the tannin in it. The less you toast it, the more tannin you leave, but the less aromatics you get. So to take a step back, a heavily toasted American oak barrel, like something that's used for bourbon, say, is starting with wood that is very aromatic and low in tannin, and then chars it very heavily, which diminishes the tannin that is present and increases those aromatics more. So from a bourbon barrel, you might get strong oak flavors of like vanilla and caramel and dill, and you're not going to get much tannin no matter how long you leave the cider in there. A low-toasted French oak barrel, so something that they might use in northern France, say in Pays d'Auge, in that, you're not going to get much aromatics, but you'll get good tannin, and it'll help round out the cider. So the best thing that we do at Fieldbird that we find works well is to try to get as many different things from that spectrum as possible, so you have different components to blend later. So the crux of that is, the more you toast a barrel, the more aromatic it becomes, the less tannin there is. So you need a mix of, if you're doing a large barrel program, you need a mix of stuff that's more toasted and less toasted, and stuff that has more tannin and less tannin. As for size, we look at surface area ratios. So a cider will extract from the wood as it's in contact with it. And the best way I can describe this is, think about how much of the cider in that barrel is touching the barrel at any point. And the more cider that's touching the barrel for how much cider is in it, the faster you're going to extract all of these things, the faster you'll extract flavor and tannins. So a good way to think about it is, if you have a warm cup of water and you put a tea bag in it, you'll get a cup of tea in about a minute. But if you have a whole teapot and you put a tea bag in it, it might take 2 or 3 minutes, because it takes longer the bigger the vessel is. So the bigger the barrel, the slower the process. The smaller the barrel, the quicker the process.
That makes sense, yeah. So and some non-commercial makers who are working with barrels, smaller barrels are also easier to move around, and they're typically making less quantity. So if they're working with a 5-gallon carboy, maybe they want to put something in like a 3-gallon barrel just so they could kind of move it around in their storage area, which is also something to consider.
But exactly.
You're working with, I mean, what's the average size of the barrels that you're working with at Fieldbird?
Gosh, we're retiring some barrels right now. I think our active barrel list is about 80 barrels right now. And probably 60 of those are 228 liters. So a standard, what we call a Burgundian barrel. So that the reason we use that size is, one, they fit on racks really well and stack really well. And the second thing is, when they're empty, it only takes one person to move them. The biggest barrels we have are 600 liters, which is like 160 gallons or something like that. They take a forklift to move, because they're just too big and too heavy. But we have three of those. And then, just like you're saying, for small projects, we have probably about a half dozen barrels that are 50 liters or smaller. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we'll put like Northern Spy in a 5-gallon barrel, and it'll extract really quickly. But we'll only have it in the barrel for a few weeks.
Okay. And Ryan, what do you mean by Burgundian?
There are two, like, most standard sizes of barrels. So a 228-liter barrel, which is kind of stubby and fat, is from Burgundy in France, and is used for Burgundy wines, so Chardonnay and Pinot Noir specifically. The other major standardized barrel size is called Bordeaux, and it's from Bordeaux in France, and is skinnier and longer, and holds a little bit less, holds up 225 liters. So even we talked about how barrel size affects extraction, but so does circumference. So a Burgundian barrel, which is fatter, you have less cider at any given point in contact with the wood. But a Bordeaux barrel, which is skinnier and longer, you have more cider in contact with the wood. So that changes extraction rates too.
Wow. A lot to take in there. Okay.
Yeah. Run quick math in your head of percentage of that cider that's touching the barrel. The higher the percentage of cider that's in contact with the barrel at any given point, the quicker you're going to extract. So the 25-liter barrels we have extract far faster than 600-liter barrels we have.
When you're looking at the size, for the barrel char and the tannin oak flavor, are you also looking at the blend of juice that you're putting in there? So a juice that would be classically, very high in tannin versus one that would be very high in that kind of acid profile.
Yeah, but it's almost converse to what you would think. So the type of tannin that's in oak, we call it sacrificial tannin, basically. So the tannin that is in a piece of untoasted oak isn't that stable. It binds with oxygen pretty quickly. It binds with other things. It's highly reactive. The tannin that's in apples, it's much slower to react. So what ends up happening is when you put cider into a barrel, especially if it has untoasted heads. So oftentimes the horizontal part of the barrel is toasted, but the round bits in the end are left untoasted. And because the less you toast something, the more tannin it has left in it, those untoasted heads have high levels of this, what we call sacrificial tannin. So when you put the cider in the barrel, there's going to be oxygen involved in it, guaranteed. There's going to be all sorts of things, yeast doing their thing, bacteria doing their thing. And all of that wants to bind with tannin. And what happens is, because the oak tannin is so reactive, it basically sacrifices itself to save the tannin in the apples. So what we try to do is, when we have a high tannic apple, when we have high tannic fruit, we put it into oak that is lower toasted and has more active tannin left in it. So newer, low toasted oak. And the reason we're doing that is we're kind of trying to preserve that tannin that's in the apple.
Yeah, I love it. Let's move on with the next question from Michael. He actually sent us three questions, and the second one, is there a recommended temperature for barrel aging?
It depends on what stage you're at in the cider making process. So we'll break it down into primary or alcoholic fermentation, possible secondary fermentation, which is bacterial, malolactic fermentation, and tertiary, which is just aging. So for primary fermentation, it depends what you're trying to say with your cider. So we use a mix of temperatures in our primary fermentation. And how we control that in barrels is where we physically put the barrels. Sometimes we'll put them outside overnight. Sometimes we'll put them, by the heater. And also a larger barrel will be warmer than a smaller barrel. So a cooler ferment, I can't run all this math in my head, but a ferment between 14 and 16 degrees Celsius is going to produce a lot of rich, floral, pretty aromatics, but won't have a lot of body to it, won't have a lot of thickness. A ferment at 20 degrees Celsius or 22, 23 degrees Celsius, so think of 70 to 75 Fahrenheit, it's going to evaporate off a lot of those pretty aromatics. But that warm temperature will create a lot of body, a lot of width and fattiness in the cider. So we like to use a mix of all sorts of different things. If you're working with one barrel, my suggestion for primary fermentation is to try to keep it cool. And the reason for that is you have no way to cool it down if it starts getting too hot. So if, as yeast produces alcohol, it's also producing heat. So that's kind of why you see when you're measuring your carboy, the temperature is going up and it can actually go above room temperature. It's because the yeast is producing that heat. If you're using a barrel, it's not like you can throw some ice cubes in it or put it in an ice bath. You're very limited in what you can do to bring its temperature down if it starts to basically have a fever. So if you're just using one or two barrels, my recommendation is to ferment at a cooler temperature until fermentation is over and then bring it to a warmer temperature for aging. So that's what I'd say for primary fermentation. If you decide you want it to go through malolactic fermentation, where you convert the acid in the apples into lactic acid, which is that creamy butterness, you want to do that around 70 degrees Fahrenheit. If it's colder than that, the bacteria will take a really long time. If it moves at all, it will take a really long time. And in that kind of in-between phase, your cider is quite susceptible to getting infected with another bacteria, like Acetobacter that could help turn it into vinegar. So for primary, it depends on what you want your cider to say. For secondary, try to keep it around 70, 72 Fahrenheit if you're wanting it to go through malolactic fermentation. And then for tertiary or aging, that depends on... Everything depends, right? All these questions are easy for me to answer because I can just like, that depends on this, that depends on this. Yeah. I can just make stuff up. But for tertiary aging, we tend to try to have stuff in the neighborhood of like 65 Fahrenheit. The reason for that is, one, we're trying to keep
Hang on a second, buddy.
Great. I'll jump back to tertiary aging. We try to keep it at, you know, in the ballpark of 65 Fahrenheit. And the quick reason for that is the warmer it is, the more likely it is to get a bad infection. But the colder it is, the slower you're going to extract the goodness from the lees. So we find like 65 Fahrenheit is a good place to be. Barrels are really hard to control the temperature on. So we're always off by 5 or 10 degrees, and that's just what it is. If it gets too cold, we have submersible aquarium heaters, and we put them in. So you can set an aquarium heater to 68 Fahrenheit and drop it in the barrel for a couple days, and then that'll get you back to kind of where you want to be.
What the heck is an aquarium heater?
Oh, like for people who keep fish at home.
Okay.
They're slightly smaller than a bunghole. I don't know.
Wow. Okay. Cool. So
they're like tubes.
Okay.
They're tubes and they have different wattages, and the wattage is based on the volume. So they're designed for aquariums. So running the math is really easy because the package will tell you how many gallons this is useful for. And you have to make sure you get there's two kinds. There's fully submersible ones, which is the ones you want because you can put them all the way in, versus like a standard aquarium heater, you have to like keep part of it above the fluid line. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if this is good public information, but this is what we do and it works really well, is we take the fully submersible aquarium heaters. And we have a couple different sizes based on what barrel size we have. They're, you know, a bunghole is a little over an inch in diameter. Mm-hmm. And an aquarium heater is about 3/4 of an inch to 1 inch. So we just drop it through the bunghole and plug it into the wall. It's got a built-in thermostat. So we say we want it to be 68 or 70 Fahrenheit, and it will regulate the temperature that way. For us, we follow a vintage cycle. So we're pressing in the fall and fermenting in the fall and into early winter. And we live in Canada, so it's pretty cold outside. So for us, if we have any temperature spikes, so we check our barrel temperatures twice a day. So if we see that something's starting to grow up in temperature to where we don't want it, we just take that barrel and put it outside.
I think it's very useful information, because I wouldn't even think of an aquarium heater. It makes absolute sense, and it's so small. And for some of the listeners out there who are definitely commercial makers, they're going to really dig this. And for the super cider geek hobbyists, they'll be able to work this out too. But watch out. You might need to tell your family you're taking the heater out of your aquarium.
don't use one that's been in fish.
I know. That would be awful.
They do make fully stainless ones, which is what we use, that we can clean really well. But they're expensive. I won't say the names of the wineries that use this technique with the less expensive ones, but it works fine.
Yeah.
Just make sure that it's fully submersible. Otherwise, you might electrocute yourself.
Ooh, we don't want that to happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, think smart while you're cider making. So we were talking about barrel aging, and so we did it was a three steps that you want to look at, and that's a primary malolactic fermentation if you want to do that. And then the third one, did you want to talk a little bit more about just...
So tertiary is or third stage is just the aging process. Mm-hmm. That can last anywhere from, 3 days to 3 years, depending on what you want to be doing. For that stage, we generally try to keep it around 65 Fahrenheit. We don't... All of the biological activity for us is complete. It's gone through primary fermentation. It's gone through secondary fermentation. So at that point, any biological activity is potentially spoilage. So keeping it a little bit cooler can slow that process down. But at the same time, if it's just cold, it'll take a long time to extract flavor and mannoprotein from the dead yeast cells, the lees. So we need to keep it a little bit warm for that. So we find our happy medium is around 65 degrees Fahrenheit.
Why would you have aging for like 3 days?
If you're trying to move quickly. So if you ferment in, there's a bunch of reasons, but the number one reason is a lot of cideries are under pressure to get stuff into packaging. Now they want to start playing with oak, but they still have these time sensitive pressures, right? They have to fulfill an order by this date. So if you extend the time it takes to do primary fermentation by using barrels and by slowing it down, and then you go through malolactic fermentation, which takes a few weeks, you might be running out of time to get it into packaging. So in that case, maybe that aging process is only a couple of days. Another reason it might be short is if you're trying to flip barrels. So if you're not on a vintage cycle like we are, if you have like juice deliveries throughout the year or over the span of several months, you might want to use your barrels for fermentation and malolactic fermentation and then empty the barrels so you can put a new batch of juice in for fermentation and malolactic fermentation. So sometimes that span is quite short. Most of the time... We see it in the neighborhood of 6 months to 1 year.
Okay, perfect. I could go off on a different track on that, but I'm going to hold that question for our next segment and go on with the third question coming in from Michael, which is, he's asking, do you see a large difference in profiles when stacking barrels on racks of the same batch of cider due to temperature changes from, say, a rack of barrels 3 to 4 barrels high, like top to bottom? And he continues with, I realize that the barrels themselves will have a varying effect individually. I was looking more at, will the top...
So this is one of our temperature management tools that we also use. We stack our barrels. Typically, our stacks are 3 to 4 high. The barrel racks we use with a Burgundian barrel, and we use regular stave, not thin stave barrels, which is a whole other conversation. But the crux of it is we're allowed to stack our barrels 6 high. We do have the height in our cellar to do that. We don't stack them that high because I don't want someone working that high. So we tend to stack our barrels about 3 high. And we have a heat vent in one of our corners that's about at the height of the third barrel. And that's where most of our cellar heat comes from. So, and I've experienced this at other wineries as well, that stacking barrels absolutely has an impact on temperature, which has an impact on aromatics and structure and time. But what most likely is the cause of that is whatever barrel's location to a heat vent or a cooling system. So if you get a barrel closer to a heater, it's going to be warmer than one farther away. And in most cellars, the heating unit is, you know, about 3 barrels high. So we sometimes put barrels up in that area if we want them to ferment at, you know, closer to 75 to 80 degrees, if we're really trying to get structure built. We'll intentionally put barrels up there by stacking them on top of other ones. The best person, if you're planning a cellar and you want this as an option for temperature control, the best person to talk to is an HVAC mechanic, because they'll be able to tell you how much heat is being put out at any given point and at what height. And then you can say, okay, so a barrel rack is this high, so that would be at my third tier or my fourth tier or my second tier. If you're fermenting, you know that you can use that as a tool. The other side of it is some cellars have in-floor heating, or some basements have in-floor heating. And if you're trying to warm it up, you can get it closer to the floor. If you're trying to cool it down, you can get it further away from the floor. So the answer is yes, definitely stacking affects temperature, but it has more to do with where the heat in that space is coming from.
What about that a tasting room that has like barrels stacked in the tasting room where it's not really a cellar? Because not all makers can trick out a whole cellar basement setup for something. Is mm-hmm. there any tips on that? Because I do see that, you know, traveling about, you're seeing some tasting rooms with barrels conditioned.
Yeah, I'm seeing that in a few places in California, which I think is super cool. I'm also it's quite popular in England, especially like during like around Herefordshire area. Mm-hmm. There's two kinds of tasting room barrels is what we'll call them. So the first is, and what's more common in America, is people who are using their tasting room space to actually age in barrel and ferment in barrel. And that works out pretty well because a tasting room is usually about 70 degrees Fahrenheit and well temperature controlled so that the guests are comfortable. So that 70 Fahrenheit, 72 Fahrenheit is a good temperature for fermenting if you're trying to extract like mouthfeel and breath and body. And it's a good temperature for malolactic fermentation. It's a little warm for secondary fermentation, but not so warm that it's going to be a big problem. So I think that works pretty well. What's common in like Herefordshire area in England, they will pour out of the barrels in the tasting room, but then they'll just fill those barrels from a tank from the cellar. So it's more used as a serving device as opposed to a fermentation or aging tool. Mm-hmm. It's just like a vessel you serve from, like almost like a keg is. Mm-hmm. And in that case, you have to be very careful about headspace. So if you have a 60-gallon barrel and you're pouring a little bit out of it each day, you're going to have a lot of air in there by the time it's at the bottom. And that air gives a lot of opportunity for bad bacteria to grow. So what we do in that case, if we have a barrel that isn't full and we don't have something of the same thing that we can fill it with, is we drop in a little bit of dry ice or carbon dioxide gas, which you can get. I mean, any commercial producer has a lot of access to carbon dioxide. And even the home producer can either buy like a small tank or can get dry ice pellets from your local bulk gas distributor. Like you can just go in and buy like a pound of dry ice. People use it for like camping trips. Mm-hmm. And if you drop one or two pellets of dry ice into a barrel and leave a vent on it, like a fermentation bung, it'll fill that empty space with carbon dioxide gas instead of air. And then that really decreases the risk of bacteria growth.
Is there any like resources you would recommend for folks who are interested in doing that to like read up on any, you know, written material on that? So folks are just kind of like dropping it in water and, you know, in their barrel. We don't want any kind of mishaps here for folks.
If it's something that makes you uncomfortable, just use gas. So what's the benefit of dry ice, and use very, very little of it, because dry ice expands enormously. The benefit of dry ice as opposed to gas carbon dioxide, a lot of home cider makers have a canister of carbon dioxide for their kegging, right? Mm-hmm. Or if they have that kind of setup, they often have a small canister of carbon dioxide. You can just put a bit of carbon dioxide in there and it'll replace the air. The benefit of dry ice is that you can put a bit in and put a vent on it, like a fermentation lock, and the gas will come off slowly and pushes all the air out as it fills up from the bottom. So you get better coverage that way. But if you have a barrel that's almost full and you drop some dry ice in there, it's going to look like it's boiling over and you're going to lose a bunch of cider. So it's only something you would do if you have like a half-filled barrel.
Yeah, and you don't want to be touching dry ice either with your hand, right?
No, use a heat glove. Your bigger risk with carbon dioxide is inhalation. So if you are using carbon dioxide and you feel lightheaded or you feel like you're getting a headache, get the hell out of that space.
Yeah.
Because the next step is passing out, and then the step after that is dying. So... Mm-hmm. So the bigger risk to using dry ice or any carbon dioxide is inhalation as opposed to burn.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's leave it like this. Anybody thinking about doing that, it's your own responsibility to do the research first.
Yeah, whoever you buy it from will tell you, ask them for the safety information, and they will give it to you in a safety data sheet with everything you need to know. Ba-dum-ba-dum.
That finishes part one of the Ask Ryan Quarantine Quad series. When we return next week with Ryan Monkman of Fieldbird Cider, he'll be discussing your options for stacking barrels and what to consider, and also talking about barrel aging and cleanliness. In the meanwhile, I hope you keep on loving it out there. This is Rhea Windcaller, signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Cider, we like ponds, we love orchards and having fun. There is a reason,
there is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider, we like palms, we like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason. There is a reason why we do it like this. Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We love orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There's a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
Ba-da-da-dum. We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We
like palms.
Oh, yes, we do.
We like orchards having some fun. Yeehaw!